Complaining by the great Jess Stacy, born on this day in 1904. So we are going to take the first part of our program today and kind of wrestle with issues facing our communities and start with the conversation that was begun by the latest part of a study done by Johns Hopkins professor who joins us here, Dr. Carl Alexander of Sociology, who joins us here. This study that took place followed almost 800 children. It's called The Long Shadow, Family Background, Disadvantage, Urban Youth, and Transition to Adulthood. Followed 800 children from kindergarten until they were 28 or 29 years old, from all classes and races across the city, and came up with some remarkable findings, which we'll talk in greater depth about when Carl joins us later, but he's here with us now to begin our show. And Carl, welcome back to the program. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mark.
Always great to hear your voice and see your work.
Thank you. And likewise, certainly enjoyed hearing your tidbits from history. Very interesting set.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So let's begin by talking about the genesis of this study.
Well, it was long in gestation, as you alluded to. We started back in 1982, my colleagues and I, and we were interested in understanding how Baltimore school children adjusted to the experience of schooling initially. So we called it the Beginning School Study, and the focus was on first grade. We did select from kindergarten rosters roughly 800 children who were starting first grade that year in schools across the city, 20 that were spread out. And we looked carefully at their first grade experience, talked to them, talked to their parents, talked to their teachers, and had access to school records. And then we just stayed with it until they were age 28, so 6 years old to age 28. With a lot of conversations along the way with them. And the book that you mentioned at the outset, The Long Shadow, is our attempt to kind of step back and take stock of how their lives have unfolded over those years.
So let's talk a bit about things you found, because our panel will begin wrestling with this in the rest of this hour, maybe into the next. But I wanted to kind of really focus in on the important aspects of this. I mean, because it's cross-class lines, cross-racial lines in your study. Right.
Yeah. Right. The original group was as diverse as was possible with the city system enrollment. As you know, back in the day and still today, it's a majority African American, low income student population. But we selected our samples in a way that would allow us to make comparisons along lines of race, class, and gender. And indeed, we saw some really quite striking differences along the way. We actually thought the book was going to be a book about school.
Yes.
And the narrative that we all encourage of our children to, work hard, play by the rules, do your homework, do what the teacher says, and good things will follow. Well, a lot of the young children in Baltimore honored that good advice, but the good things didn't necessarily follow. When we talked to them at age 28, only 4% of the children that we classify as being from disadvantaged families, their parents didn't finish high school on average, and they had low-level work and erratic employment histories. Only 4% of those children age 28 had a bachelor's degree, had finished 4 years of college. That compares with 45% of children whose parents were of middle-class background, so that's a tenfold difference in college completion. And the figures for completing the two-year degree were even more dismal, just 1.5% of poor children or disadvantaged children had an associate of arts degree at age 28. Wow. So this past the upward mobility that we hold out for young people whose family struggle at the outset doesn't seem to materialize for the children who grew up in Baltimore during this period. And what we characterize that pattern as a pattern of middle-class family advantage, because children in middle-class parentage have the advantage all the way along in school, and at the outset in first grade, their test scores are higher on average, and the test score differential comparing advantaged and disadvantaged children increases over time. As a result of that and other considerations, poor children are more likely to be held back in grade along the way. They're more likely to be assigned to receive special education services. They're tracked into high school, middle grade classes and high school classes that channel them away from college, and they drop out in high numbers because they've experienced nothing but disappointment and failure.
And also, from what I've read, and I'm looking forward to reading the entire book, but I haven't had a chance to finish it all yet. When we do, Carl, we'll get back to this in a deeper way, but we will with our panel as much as we can as well today. But that this was the juxtaposition, the meeting of class and race were really critical to this too. Where part of what you found was that in the poorest people who grew up in the poorest homes in terms of income, that white people who came from those homes had a better chance of making more money in the trades, construction, and more than did the black kids coming out of the same circumstances. That's an interesting piece.
Oh, it's very interesting. I mean, that's what I would call the second large storyline. So, yeah, not all Baltimore school children are going to succeed at school and complete college. We realize that. It's a tough fall. But there are other ways to get self-established as young adults, find jobs with steady work and high pay. And what's so striking in the experiences of these 800 youngsters that we tracked over a quarter century is that white men of low-income background had a decided advantage in the workplace when they were taking jobs without the benefit of a college degree. In fact, 45% of white men of working-class background as young adults were working in the high-pay, high-skill industrial crafts, you know, things like electricians, plumbers, welders, brick masons, auto mechanics. That's 45% compared to 15% of African-American men of a very similar background. So a large difference in access to that sector of employment. And then if you look just at the young men who were working in the trades along those lines, the white men were earning double what the African-American men were earning. So there's a question of access to the skilled trades, and then there's a second question of who's actually getting the high-pay, high-skill work. And it's relegated. It's a privilege that's reserved almost exclusively for white men of working-class background. And this is, we see this in the context of a deindustrialized Baltimore, where we're told that the industry has disappeared or fled abroad or gone to low-wage sectors of the country, and there just isn't an opportunity for that kind of work any longer. Without the benefit, you just can't get by without a college degree. Well, that's only half true. You know, if you look around, there's still buildings going up in Baltimore. There's still road repairs being done. There's still unloading ships at the dock. And so the question really is, who's getting those jobs? And at least in the experiences of our study youngsters, it's disproportionately white men of working class background, and mainly because they have advantages in terms of social network advantages in finding work. You know, a lot of these jobs are filled word of mouth by recommendation, and if you're in the right social network, you have an edge.
So, Carl, before we have to go to our next segment here, because we will come back to this again with you, and we are going to talk about this with our panel when we take after this break, what was the other major subtext for you in this book?
Well, my goodness, you don't have much time, I know. We looked at the neighborhoods that these young people were growing up in, the working class and low-income neighborhoods, and the African-American and white neighborhoods had very similar economic profiles. If you look at the percentage unemployed, if you look at the median household income, if you look at the median price of housing, you know, practically interchangeable. But the African-American neighborhoods suffered much greater levels of property and violent crime, despite the similarity of the economic circumstances. And they suffered from much weaker social cohesions, which challenges the families who are living there. And we think it's a historical account that helps make sense of that in terms of racial residential segregation historically that has kept black and white Baltimore apart. But beyond that, African-American communities, low-income African-American communities were much more subject to the dislocations associated with public works progress. You know, our highway to nowhere displaced thousands of African-American families and shut down the pocket parks that were places of gathering on the west side. The urban unrest that followed the assassination of Martin Luther King was concentrated in low-income African-American neighborhoods, and hundreds of businesses were shuttered as a result of that, and many of them never reopened. So there are reasons behind the differences we see, but the differences themselves are quite striking.
Carl, this has been a fascinating study, and I'm really looking forward to getting into it a great deal more depth. We have a panel here who's going to kind of wrestle with some of the stuff we talked about with you.
Sure.
And if you'd like to hang around, we'd love to have you. I know you. If you can't, that's fine.
I can do that. I'll stay on the line.
All right, sweetie.
It's my pleasure.
Well, let me go right into introducing the guests that are here with us right now, joining this conversation. Dr. Carsonia Whitehead, or Kay Whitehead, is here with us once again in the studio, Assistant Professor of Communication and Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and African-American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland, author of Notes from a Color Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, which is an amazing book, and was just honored by the National Progressive by the Progressive Baptist as what was your honor again?
Yes, I received the President's Lifetime Achievement
Award.
From the Progressive National Baptist Convention.
Bill Fletcher joins us, racial justice, labor, and international activist, author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions, senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies, and immediate past president of the Trans-Africa Forum. Bill, welcome back. Always good to have you with us.
Always good to be on the program.
Adora Ayira is with us, project manager of More in the Middle Campaign for Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst at Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of fusion partnerships. Adora, good to have you back as well.
Thank you for inviting me.
Jordan Bloom is with us, opinion editor of the Daily Caller, a board member of Alumni for Liberty, a project of the Students for Liberty. And Jordan, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Great to be back.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log into our Facebook pages. Oh, it's on that Steiner Show. Excuse me. We're now, sorry, we have a brand new email address, which is talk@steinershow.org. I got to remember that. talk@steinershow.org, 410-319-8888. So let me get some thoughts. Bill Fletcher, I know you were here from the very beginning listening. Let me let you begin.
Well, I felt like, once again, in listening to your guest, it reminded me of the Coates article on reparations, that it basically was laying out once again the way that structural racism exists, that it's not imaginary. This is not about unfortunate circumstances, that there's a structural differential that's built in that must be addressed. And I felt like that was the most powerful thing that jumped out in listening to you again.
Jordan, what jumped out at you?
Well, I think that I might have a bit of a different take on this, but I think it, a couple of things jump out. And number one, and I'm really glad Dr. Alexander just mentioned it, is that overwhelmingly the victims of progressive social policy are poor black people. From eminent domain to the weakening of social mores, there's another bit there about how the people who, drug users, it's affluent white people that abuse drugs at the highest rates, but they don't suffer the hardest for it. And, so progressive mores with regard to sex and drugs, the people who end up being victims of this stuff are always poor black people.
Adar.
Hey, Marcus, this is Carl again. You mind if I jump in here because to elaborate on a point?
Sure, go ahead, Carl. Then we'll go right to Adar Ayira. Go ahead.
Yeah, so when we asked these the young people in our study group about things like drug use, it was really quite extraordinary. White men of middle-class background had the highest self-reported rates of binge drinking, marijuana use, and heavy drug use, which for us means any drug other than marijuana. White men of middle-class background, but substantially they were doing these things in college and could be protected by their parents from fallout, at least the most severe kinds of fallout. The next highest rates of self-reported use of all three of those, binge drinking, marijuana use, and heavy drug use, were white men of working class background. So African American men kind of lag behind on all those indicators, but they suffered the consequences most severely in terms of the implications for limited workplace opportunities. I mean, we know from the larger literature that employers in the non-college labor market are much more likely to ask about a criminal record of African American applicants than white applicants, and so those differences across social lines come through really quite starkly in the experiences of our study group.
I'm glad you raised that, because we've talked often about the mass incarceration in America, and this is part of what underlies what you were talking about here. That is a result of what your study talks about here. But, Adar, you were about to say what? Then I have some very specific questions after Kay.
I am so glad that Carl raised that point. I agree with Bill that it really does get to the structural and the institutional race-based barriers in our society. And those barriers are there and remain there and have been generational, regardless of whether there are conservative or progressive. It is still in large part about the criminalization of groups of people, and that is race-based.
One of the things that stuck out to me with the article is that it really gives us an opportunity to talk about intersectionality. Where are the places where race and class overlap with one another, where you may be able to struggle economically, but because of institutionalized and systemic racism, you don't have that opportunity to fail and still have a chance to start all over again. I think what's interesting is that I struggle with this at Loyola, and I challenge my students to think about some of the reasons why students of certain races are able to fail up. They have a safety net, so even if they do fall into drugs or fall into alcohol or fail out of school, there's a safety net set there for middle-class parents that I think that we don't often look at. We blame so much of it on race, and I do think race is a factor, but I think people tend to overlook that safety net of class that in some ways tends to overlook a number of barriers around race. As a middle-class African-American parent, do I have that safety net for my students? Can I move them out of the community? Can I put them in better schools?
My children.
Yeah, that's right. My parents.
You said your students.
My parents and my students would love that, but I'm talking about my own children.
Right.
But that is a safety net that class has afforded me.
And I think, and there's some interesting pieces here with that. And I think that this juxtaposition can lead to a lot of discussions. You could take this report, I think, and go through it over a period of weeks and kind of discuss pieces of it to see where we are. One of the things that struck me also when we talked about this was the poor working class people, black or white, and what happened, what kind of jobs people got as they grew older. Mm-hmm. And I think there's this long history in Maryland and in the country period, but in Maryland especially that I know about, where our unions were segregated. We had a black carpenter's local and a white carpenter's local.
Right.
Every union had a black and white local. And almost every tradesperson, and Carl is correct, when people hire people and they're tradesmen, the plumbers that come to fix your plumbing in your home, the electrician that works in a building, the refrigeration mechanic,
right.
They hire people they know. And they hire people from places they know, and they know primarily people in their own worlds. And those kids get hired to become the next generation of electricians. So the question is, how do you change that? Because one of the things that I think that, you know, I was thinking about when I was spoke to a group of high school graduates about 6 months ago, young people who had dropped out of school and gone to these programs, and I looked out on the roof. And I said, you see all those things on the roof here, these mounds, you know what they are? A few kids did. They said, yeah, those are air conditioning units. I said, yeah, they are. And do you have an idea how much men and women make who fix those units and keep those things going? What worlds can be built without having to have a BA degree? You don't have to have a bachelor's degree to survive and make this world. And you can still be a poet and you still can paint pictures and you can fix air conditioners. So how do you get beyond what Carl found in his study that gets to a place, we're going to break after I say this, that gets to a break, that gets to a place where that kind of statistic no longer exists. We're going to wrestle with that when we come back. Stay with us. Don't go away. Of course, that's Lift Every Voice and Sing by the Morgan State Choir. And we're playing that for you today because John Rosman Johnson, the man who composed that, was born on this day in 1873, the Negro National Anthem. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Please join us with your ideas. Write to us at talk@steinershow.org. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. As we talk with Dr. Kay Whitehead, Bill Fletcher, Jordan Bloom, Adar Ayira, and the man who wrote the report, Carl Alexander, we're talking about The Long Shadow, Family Background, Disadvantage of Urban Youth, and the Transition to Adulthood, 410-319-8888. We'll come to the calls in a moment, but let me first ask to wrestle with the finding and what we do about it. So what is a way that we address this reality in our world?
I think there are a number of solutions. This is Kay again. What I think is interesting with what you pose, how do we get our students, our young people, to begin to see themselves beyond their current situation? When I used to be a school teacher and I would talk to my students about their future, the students wanted to be basketball players. They wanted to be rappers. They wanted to be models. Nobody talked about being an electrician, putting in air conditioners, being a doctor. And every time I brought these ideas up, oh, that's going to take too long. I want immediate success. That the students weren't being encouraged to put the work in to begin to move themselves beyond. There were a couple things that came out in this study that I thought were very interesting. This idea that's not mentioned, but I tend to call it grit. There was a talking about this woman named Monica, that she wanted something better for her son, that she decided to change her life, to move outside of Baltimore, to get a better job, and look to push her 17-year-old and her 7-year-old farther than she went. What is that called? I think that that quality of wanting something better and being able to stick to it and put in the hard work, is that enough to move you out of this situation? I don't know. I'm wrestling with it. I want to hear what the other panelists think about that.
Because that's also, that sense is what pushed the Europeans to become, and Jews to be the diaspora to come to America.
Yeah.
That's what pushed black folks from the South to the North for 50 years in another immigration, internal immigration in America, for just those reasons.
Mark, this is Bill.
Bill Fletcher, sorry, go ahead.
Let me give a slightly different answer, response.
Go ahead.
I think that sometimes we mystify this.
Uh-huh.
The answer is fundamentally structural, just as the problem is structural. In other words, if you want to address, it took more than 100 years to structure in racism in this country, beginning with the 1619 importation of Africans. It did not happen immediately. In order for that to be implanted, there were structures that were put in place in order to drive real wedges between the European colonists and the African indentured servants and later slaves. It wasn't imaginary. It wasn't about history lessons. It wasn't about Bible. It was structural. When we're looking at this situation, we have to understand the same thing. When the United States, after World War II, found itself with hundreds of thousands of veterans, it didn't say, hey, listen, you know what? You need to go out there and get a job. Stop complaining about how bad it was in the war. You know, life was rough. Just get yourself together. No, there was something called the GI Bill that was put into place that made it possible for people like my father to move from a situation where he had been a high school dropout to entering into graduate school. And the reality is that the GI Bill benefited whites more than it did African Americans, because African Americans were disproportionately knocked out of the military system. But the GI Bill and subsequent assistance on housing and other things had a structural impact. This was not just it wasn't about mores, values, or anything else. It was about structures. And so we can't run away from that. There have to be structural mechanisms that are put into place to address this. Otherwise, in another 10 years, we'll have the same discussion.
And I do want to kind of explore what those structural mechanisms might be. Let me go to Adar and then Jordan, then I'll open the phones. Adar.
Here, just picking up on that, here is one way in which that might look. What we do know is that for students, for individuals, families coming from poor neighborhoods, middle-class neighborhoods, whatever, that African Americans and other communities of color are over-policed. The ACLU did a report just talking about marijuana, and it showed that in every single county in the state of Maryland, no matter how few African Americans were in that county, they were arrested and convicted at higher rates than the whites who used the most of the drugs. It is structural, and people with privilege do not see that. When we talk about going to college, we have to start at the pre-K through 12 level getting people ready. We know that in some schools in Baltimore, it is hard just to go to a school that where you can learn algebra, which is a core subject. We look at schools, we look at the amount of money that we spend on students, and then we turn around and even despite the disparity, we say, okay, there is something wrong with you and your family. It is something wrong, but it is something wrong with the structure. The structure is broken. The people are not.
Jordan, after this, I'll open the phones. I'm sorry. I'm not
Dr. Alexander's study, there are a couple of other things that sort of dovetail nicely with it about the persistence of a lack of social mobility. Like Gregory Clark's book, he looked at surnames in England, and he found that to this day, 1,000 years later, Norman surnames are still overrepresented at Cambridge and Oxford. That's pretty interesting. So if you're going to take... And the other thing that he found is that there's not a whole lot you can do to reduce that, like in terms of activist government policy. So there are two ways you could think of approaching this problem. You could either talk about programs to get people out of, you know, these bad neighborhoods, these bad life circumstances, or you could try to create conditions in those neighborhoods for sort of informal social solidarity to return, like it once was. And I guess I'm partial to the second option. I guess how it would look in terms of policy, it would be an emphasis on strengthening social safety nets and getting people into the skilled trades versus opportunity scholarships to Harvard. Does that make sense?
I hear what you're saying. Yeah. I think let me go to the phone, Jim. We can have at that. Adara is shaking her head like she doesn't quite agree, so we'll hear by Adara Dustin, and we'll come back to that. 410-319-8888. Barry, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Barry.
I just wanted to comment on the availability of vocational training. All the vocational programs have been eliminated. I'm a retired carpentry teacher. I taught at-risk youth. I was director of a program in Southeast D.C. called ARCH, Action to Rehabilitate Community Housing. We graduated 300 people a year, gave them $300 worth of tools, and got them a job. But there are no such programs to do that nowadays.
Wow.
So my thing is there are no programs to train these people, because everybody's not going to college. The other thing is they have no male role models to show you how to fix your house or how to do electrical work. And the other thing is the young kids now want to do Xbox and they're lazy. They don't want to work.
I heard that part too, Barry. I was thinking about what you just said. There was a piece on Morning Edition that I heard recently about you can listen to any of your broadcasts like that anytime on your podcast now. So I listened to that, and it was that in New York City there's a program to teach kids these construction trades early, but nonprofits have to do it. There's no money in the school system left to do it anymore. So it has to come from the outside again. This was part of our system. I mean, everybody I knew grew up had a vocational class in school. You had that growing up all the time. That's become fallen by the way. So what Barry says, I think, is very critical. Barry, you still on the line?
Yeah.
Let me say a quick question. Was the program that you ran, was it federally funded or city funded?
It was funded by Pepco, the power company in D.C.
Uh-huh.
And what we did, we bought houses, we rehabbed them, we trained during the rehab. And the first house we completed, we sold to one of the students. Mm.
That's interesting, Barry. Thanks so much. And I'd love to hear more about this. I think it's a fascinating program and idea. Adara, you're about to say what before we go back to the phones?
While all of these solutions sound reasonable, there is an economic price tag. When we talk about higher education and we talk about trades, yes, there are some trade positions that are highly paid. Yes, not everyone is going to college. But, Mark, there are 468 really selective high-tier colleges in the United States. Most of them have white students going to them. When those students graduate, they have a potential for $2 million per student more in earnings and lifetime advantages. That is what they get. So saying, okay, we can steer lower-income people into trades, that sounds reasonable, sounds logical. But when you look at economic parity, economic development, and economic mobility, that is not quite the answer.
But who's about to say something?
Can I
was going to read this.
Who is this?
Carl.
Carl, go ahead, Carl. Then we'll go over to Kay. Go ahead, Carl.
It's not my turn. Yeah, Carl. No, I think the point just made is right on target. You know, in the ideal world, and this isn't that world, we would have vastly greater numbers of our children, maybe especially our poor children, continuing on into college and completing college. you know, there's the rates of high school, I'm sorry, the rates of high of college non-completion are vastly higher than rates of high school dropout nowadays. So many children, young children, start down that path, but for various reasons, you know, get thrown off track. And the challenges are not exclusively academic. You know, there are issues of strong skill set coming in. But when we talk to our study participants, we hear time and again about the practical challenges outside school that weigh on them. And we have some examples that make the point quite vividly in the book. But poor kids are much more likely to attend school part-time than full-time. They're much more likely to attend as commuter students. They're much more likely to experience an interruption along the way. They might have to drop out for a period of time to take care of a needy child or a needy parent or to help out at home in some other way or to cobble together the tuition for the upcoming semester or to pay for books. So it's there are these very practical, very real obstacles that weigh especially upon the low-income college students. And children of middle-class background and above are much more likely to take what we call the fast track into and through college. And they enroll immediately after high school. They enroll full-time. They stay the course and don't drop out. Often they're residential students, you know, living away from home, and that increases integration into college life. So, sure, college would be the preferred course far and away for all the reasons mentioned. But for young people who are not going to college, we also have to think about, ambitiously, I think, about employment opportunities where you can still have steady work and high pay without the benefit of a college degree. So it really requires an assault on two fronts in parallel. But absolutely, we shouldn't. No one here is suggesting that we turn away from the college path.
Mark, this is where it gets structural. When we say, yes, the majority of or many African Americans and other people of color are lower income and they do not have the access or the opportunity to go to college because of financial reasons or other reasons, place-based reasons, whatever. And then you have more of a population of white students who have a social, familial safety network there to help propel them not just to college but through college. You still are setting up and maintaining a two-tier society economically. And that's where the structural piece comes in. So unless we are willing to look at these things with a racial equity lens, then we are going to always get what we get.
I completely agree. But also making opportunities available. If we start thinking about opening up only to low-income communities, this idea of trade being an option, you must learn a trade before you can do anything, as if college is not the option for them, that they don't have an opportunity to go there, that all they can do is find a trade, as if those that come from middle-class and upper-class families cannot have that option. College is the only path for you because you must remain in this system where you're educating your mind so you can become the leaders and not the workers of our community. It's what Adair said about this idea of a two-tier system. I just want to very quickly say, our caller talked about our kids being lazy, sitting in front of the Xbox. I get very concerned about that. It's the same thing that was said 20 years ago. Our kids are lazy. They sit in front of the television. I tell parents now, like I said then, turn the TV off. Take the Xbox away from them. Students are learning what we teach them. If we put them in front of the computers, put them in front of the Xbox, we're training them in that way. We have to give them other opportunities. Take them to the library instead. Give them a chance to succeed.
410-319-8888. Go back to other guests. Let's go to Jim. You're on the line. Jim Morgan, you're on the line.
Hi, it's actually Ken Morgan.
I'm sorry. Oh, Ken, how are you, man? Good, good. Been a long time.
I'm doing fine.
Good.
One of the things that you asked in the beginning is what can be done about it. And I think it you have to have a historical approach to this. And the bottom line for me is that we can work towards equality, but without drastic structural economic and political changes, there can be no equality. However, we can work towards equality, number one. Number two, a part of all of this has to do with looking at how black people have gained working towards equality, and that's been through struggle. And I don't mean just the rhetoric of struggle. If we look at the whole aspects of things, if we look at things, we also look at the kind of the CIO when black and white working people actually made certain kinds of demands on both the company, the governments, and the union. So I think that there is a prescription, but I find it hard to understand where these anecdotal kinds of things will suffice. Let me just give you one final example. With Carver High School, Carver High School is a vocational school. I'm working presently with some students and actually a baseball coach, and part of their aim is to try to get job opportunities for these young people who are in the trades, who find it difficult, if not impossible, to get any kind of jobs. So I think that we have to get away from the anecdotal aspects of things and look at what is and what can affect the road to equality, especially for African American working people.
Ken Morgan, it's always good to hear your voice, man. Looking forward to having you back on the program as a guest.
Take care.
You too. 410-319-8888. Bill, you want to comment?
Not sure that I actually understood what the caller was raising, to be honest. So maybe some other guest should comment.
Well, I'd like to add, this is Kay, this notion of the road to equality. I mean, I think equality, I often laugh about this term. I'm not quite sure exactly what that would look like in our society. I don't think we've actually ever had that. What does real equality actually mean? But I do think that perhaps one of the roads to getting there for lower income communities goes through the school system. When we start talking about training our students to even be college ready, college ready does not necessarily mean you're going to go to college. It means you have those college preparatory skills that will allow you to succeed in whatever you want to do. It starts much earlier than high school and middle school. We're talking kindergarten and students going into the classroom already being prepared, coming from a print-rich environment, being told they're going to be successful. I don't know if any of you have gone into the independent schools around the city, but I've gone into those schools, and I've heard teachers tell the students, you are the future of our world. The schools are clean. They're big, bright libraries. The students are expected to succeed. At the same time, I've gone to some very challenged city schools, public schools here in Baltimore City, where the students are told to sit down, shut up, and be quiet, not to think deeply, not to think critically, not to think you are the future, but just to be quiet so we can get through the day.
So let me, I think that's an important point. That's also shown to itself and something we have talked about in this program for the last 21 years, which is the kind of structures we put on children in our public schools. Mm-hmm. Are antithetical to what kids experience in independent and private schools. Yeah. And why should we begin to think about what those schools do as if because you're poor and come from a disadvantaged background economically, that you're not allowed to have this kind of freedom of education, which is, to me, just insanity. But let me talk about other pieces.
Mark, that misses it. I have to intervene.
Bill.
The assumption, when we guarantee public education for all students, not the smartest, right? Not the richest, but for all students, by definition, you're going to have a mixed bag in each of the classes.
Right.
And when you do not put sufficient resources into the schools to lower the number of students per classroom, you get what you get. You can't compare self-selecting private institutions where parents have chosen to put their children into a school they've decided to take their own resources to put them in because they've had the resources. You can't compare that with public with a general public school. It's completely unfair, and it's actually, with all due respect, it's disingenuous. The reality is that if we want good public education, since you can find this in other parts of the world, the recipe is actually fairly clear. You have to put the resources, you have to minimize the number of students per class, and there has to be a broader social commitment to educating the youth. And part of what happens with African Americans, and it relates to what one of your guests raised about the link of race and class, is that when you have a situation where we're both segregated, but also low income, this opportunity to opt out and to go in another way, go another path, it's not available. So I just think it's unfair.
No, let me just jump in here because we have not heard from Jordan in a bit. I'm going to get Jordan's voice back in here. And just say I agree with you, Bill. I don't think we disagree on that at all. I was just saying that the curricula that we give children in private schools should be the curricula we give children in our public schools.
Yes,
that's true, and I completely agree with the other guests about the emphasis being on pre-college education rather than college education, because we're really headed for a reckoning in this country. College is absurdly overvalued,
yes,
and we're never going to tackle that problem by just throwing more money at it. Likewise, frankly, with K-12 public schools, funding is at historically high levels. But what you can do is give the parents the element of choice. I'm a pretty big believer in school choice, though, you know, the results have been sort of mixed. But just empowering the parents to withdraw their consent from a school system that they don't like is an incredibly important competitive element that can force schools to improve.
So, very quickly, because I do this, we only have like 5 or 6 minutes left in this conversation. I want to get a quick call in here, and we'll come to our other two guests in the studio, 410-319-8888. Dre, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Joe.
This argument reminds me of the argument with W.E.B. Du Bois and them in the early 19th century. And the part of the problem that still hasn't been addressed is the structural racism in American society is still impacting people of color in a negative way. And until Congress and Senate and the White House address the structural issues that racism has caused, we're still standing here almost 100 years later having the same argument of college education versus skill set training for African American and people of color. We need to change the institutional part of racism that's ingrained in our government and in our American society if we're going to ever move the needle on this issue.
Jay, thanks so much for the call. I mean, I think the panel, you pretty much agree with what people
said. I don't think
the panel.
Anybody here would disagree with you. I just want to throw this out because it is so easy to get distracted or to give the class-based argument primacy. In the 2011 to 2012 school year, 8,000 preschoolers were suspended at least once. 18% of children in school are African descendant. 48% of those students were suspended more than once. African-American boys represented 54% of the preschool population and 82% of those suspended multiple times. That isn't class-based. That is race-based. And unless we also start to talk about the cultural stereotypes that we bring into the classrooms as well as every place else in society and the way that those impact, even in preschool, the opportunities, the chances, and the choices of our children, then we're not going to solve this problem.
So there's another piece of this I just wanted to throw out here because I thought it was fascinating. We might, if you all have time, let this conversation spill over another 5 minutes or so into the next hour, if you all have time to do that. But when the piece that you researched, Carl, about drug use and drug use being – there's so many aspects of this, drug use being more prevalent or in higher numbers among white privileged people and men in particular, says a lot both about the dangers and non-dangers of drug abuse on somebody's life and work, and B, says a lot about the structural racism in our society and who gets arrested and who doesn't. And to me, adds another level to our conversation about what the legalization or decriminalization of drugs in our society. I found that part of your piece to be open a lot of doors.
Well, there was the ACLU report that was alluded to on focus on marijuana. It's really a riveting read, and people who are interested in these issues ought to track it down. But I think a large issue here is that, you know, in today's world, and maybe especially so in low-income communities, lots of young people take a misstep along the way. You know, they might get in trouble with law, they might get involved with using drugs or even selling drugs. The vast majority of those young people outgrow it, so to speak. You know, the very small percentage turn into what you might call career criminals. So as they get a little older, they get a little wiser, and they assume, you know, family responsibilities, and they kind of straighten themselves out. But the legacy of those problems weigh much more heavily on the prospects of African-American youth than they do of whites. And I say that's a large issue. And it ties in with structural issues and institutional issues. But I'm a sociologist, and I think structure all the time. But there are also these informal mechanisms that are very real and very powerful, like the informal hiring networks that exclude young people who just aren't tied in in an advantageous way. Yeah, a lot of the structure that used to maintain the patterns of inequality that are still with us today, at least on paper, they're gone. Yeah, you mentioned the apprenticeship programs, the union. So union membership is now formally open. Banks can't redline the way they used to, so the patterns of residential segregation aren't maintained nowadays by official policy and procedures. We have equal employment opportunity legislation, so a lot of the formal structure has changed, but what we see around us today is substantially maintained by the informal practices that have built up around those structures. And that I think, poses even more challenging problems, because you can't legislate away
right.
parents wanting to help their children get good jobs when there's an uncle who can get the kid in.
Mm-hmm.
You can't legislate away middle-class parents wanting to help their children do well in school and using all the tools available to them.
Right.
Right. Absolutely.
We have to take a very brief break. We want to come back and just close out this conversation with all of you to talk about, I mean, one of the things to me that's very important in this study is like the books that Carl Alexander writes in this particular book is that they aren't just mere academic exercises to sit on a shelf. To describe something about us, about our society and where we are.
Right.
And then we have to wrestle with what these findings say about what we do about our society and how we change it. So these things we study don't end up being the norm for the next generations to come. We'll take a very brief break and tackle that question before we hit who's going to own our water. Stay with us.
Stern, firm, and young with a laid-back tongue. The aim is to succeed and achieve at 21. Just like Ringling Brothers, our days in a sound. Captivate the mass because the pose is profound. Do it for the strong, we do it for the meek.
That's Almighty God. For those angels by Duke Ellington and Russell Prokopy, who was born on this day, not Russell was, not Duke, on this day in 1908. So as we continue our day in history, let's conclude this conversation we're having now. Dr. Carl Alexander co-authored the book The Long Shadow, Family Background, Disadvantaged Urban Youth, and the Transition to Adulthood. By the way, he's an academy professor and sociology research professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins. And he and I will be appearing together at Enoch Pratt Library to talk about this book and more in next month. And talking about that book with us, Adara Ayira is with us, project manager of the More in the Middle campaign for Associated Black Charities, a facilitator and analyst of Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of Fusion Partnerships. Jordan Bloom is opinion editor of the Daily Caller, board member of Alumni for Liberty, a project of Students for Liberty. Bill Fletcher is a racial justice labor international activist, author of They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions, a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies, an immediate past president of Trans-Africa Forum, and Dr. Kay Whitehead, who is assistant professor of communication and affiliate assistant professor of African and African-American Studies at Loyola University of Maryland, author of our latest book, Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis. And let's just get some concluding thoughts about where you think this takes us. Let me start with you, Jordan, then we'll go to Bill Fletcher, to Adara, and conclude with Kay very quickly to kind of round out this conversation. Jordan?
I just go back to what I said earlier, that it's relatively easy to create a scholarship program to get a few overperforming kids out of the ghetto. It's a lot more difficult to reinstill the sort of social solidarity that maybe existed before, you know, the days of eminent domain, before the days of, you know, aggressive policing and things like that. That's a harder fix. And I think in a lot of ways it can't necessarily be accomplished with money. That's kind of my takeaway.
Bill Fletcher.
Well, I think that we need a whole lot more money to address some of these structural issues. Unfortunately, we live in a society that has refused to take responsibility for the fact of the racial differential in treatment that has permeated it since the 1600s. And when you have that refusal, then you can't address these problems except in very symbolic ways. To borrow from the previous guest, a few scholarships here or there, or certain charter schools that receive a great deal of attention. But in terms of getting, doing a real transformation, it can't be done unless there is a massive social commitment, the way this society committed itself to veterans after World War II.
Okay, Dora, go ahead. Dora Yira.
Thank you. We need to not put the focus on people. It would be great if we had more solid communities like the 60s or whatever. That would be fine. However, it would not change the structural issues, the cultural race-based behaviors that we see and that are truncating people's lives, their opportunities, their choices, their ability to build assets. It is the system that needs to change. And if we do not look at and address race-based disparities and a system set up to support that, then we're not really having real conversation, nor are we working toward real change.
I think we need to explore further this idea of intersectionality. Where does race, class, and gender overlap? We've spoken a lot about race and class today. We really did not touch gender. And there is a big movement happening now to get girls added to the president's movement. There's this focus on boys. We're talking about what's happening with girls, although we did not discuss it in this program. I also think we need to look at what is working in our society. There are so many things that are wrong, and we can't solve everything at the same time. How do we chunk it and take small pieces and deal with one issue at a time? And finally, we talked earlier about comparing independent schools to public schools. I want to be clear. I know that's apples and oranges, but you can't apply oranges to oranges. There are public schools like Roland Park and Mount Washington and Hamilton that are getting it right. Why can't we use those public schools as models for other public schools?
Well, I want to thank all of you for being with us. And Dr. Carl Alexander, thank you so much for putting for this book. And we look forward to taking parts of this book for other discussions over the next couple of months. And you can join Carl Alexander and I will be together at the Enoch Pratt Library on October the 6th in the evening around 7:30 for a conversation that we'll be taping as well. But leading up to that, we'll be having many more conversations about this. We did not touch on the women's issues in this, which we should have, but we got hung on one issue, and we're going to come back to more of these later. Thank all of you for joining us here for this conversation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
You all. We can take a brief break. We come back. We're going to talk about our water. Who owns it? Who will own it?
Like a tribe does. Before this, did you really know what I was? Comprehend.